How's everybody doing tonight?
Awesome. Thank you for being here. Awesome. So fun to see you guys. I don't usually walk on a stage that has bombs on it, so that's pretty intimidating. I don't know if any of you, how many people here are fans of the 1990 Memphis Belle? Let's hear it. I've been telling people, when I try to explain that movie, that for my generation, I was born in 1980, that, thank you, one person. I just need to call it. Somebody told me that that was the late 1900s, and I immediately felt 105 years old. So, but for people born around that time period, Memphis Belle, the 1990 movie, was that was our 12 o'clock high. That was our generation's example of that. Folks before us had that movie, 12 o'clock high or The War Lover. You know, my uncle took me to see Top Gun when I was a kid. He told my mom that he was taking me to a Disney movie. And then that same uncle, though, took me to see Memphis Belle. And as cool as Top Gun was, I love that movie, there was something different about Memphis Belle. And it was something that I thought I could go to and be sort of strive to. I can access maybe a B-17. And there was one actually being restored in our hometown. And I got to go out and take a look at it. I ended up volunteering about the age of 12. I don't know if we have that photo. If we do, that's my buddy Rob Morelli next to me. I wish I'd known that photo was going to be more important. I would have worn something not as 1990s as that. You guys can be jealous of my Reeboks pumps. But that was a day that was, man, that was like seeing a rock star, seeing that airplane. That was the movie Belle. And I never imagined I would have the chance to get to host some of the actors and some of the people who supported the film, directed the film here at the World's Greatest Air Show, and that's exactly what we're going to do tonight. So you're in for a great adventure here. Leading the conversation tonight is someone who I'm really honored to call my friend and a professional mentor, and that is Jeff Dufert. Jeff Dufert led the restoration of the real Memphis Belle that is currently displayed down in Dayton, Ohio at the Air Force Museum. So if you've ever been down there and saw that, a lot of this is his work. So you're going to be in good hands with him. We're about to kick it off, but we're going to actually show the trailer first, and then we're going to welcome Jeff up on stage. So let's check out the trailer. Thank you guys for being here.
It was a time when a generation came together to fight for freedom.
So that's the crew of the Memphis Belle, huh?
They're just ordinary men, Colonel.
They fly 24 missions without a scratch. That doesn't sound very ordinary to me.
Bomber checking in.
Assume positions for takeoff.
A time when boys became soldiers.
Sir, that's the Third Reich down there.
30 seconds to bomb run.
Have you?
Why? Am I doing something wrong?
Strangers became brothers.
I know that I shall meet my fate somewhere among the clouds above.
Look out! Take out the rookies!
Smile? What is there to smile about, sir?
You guys have finished 24 missions. One more and you get to go home. That sure make me smile.
Target for today. Bremen.
From the producer of Chariots of Fire, Matthew Modine, Eric Stoltz.
I know you want to drop the bombs to get the hell out of here.
And it's 5 o'clock.
We asked these boys to become men.
If we don't do it, somebody's going to have to come back here again and do it for us.
We asked these men to become heroes.
Get out of the way!
And whatever the danger, whatever the odds.
It's our job, ours, nobody else's.
Bomb doors open.
We ask them to come home. Memphis Belle.
Well, good evening, everyone. First, I'd like to thank the EAA and Chris Henry for putting together this wonderful event and bringing us all together to talk about this really, really important part of our nation's history. The Memphis Belle, it's kind of hard to talk about how important it is because it means so many things. But probably most importantly, it's a symbol. It's a symbol of service. It's a symbol of sacrifice. The Army Air Forces picked that airplane to represent, to be the symbol for the heavy bomber crews in the fight against Germany. And it's not well known, but there were over 30,000 airmen killed in heavy bombers in the fight against Germany. That is half of the combat deaths in the entire history of the United States Air Force going back to World War I. So there's the heavy bomber crewmen, and the other half are all the other airmen killed in all the wars we've been in. And also, we lost 8,000 heavy bombers in the fight against Germany. The Memphis Belle represents those air crews in the same way that the flag raising on Mount Suribachi, that symbol that we all recognize, that represents the service and sacrifice of Marines, and the Arizona at Pearl Harbor represents the service and sacrifice of our Navy sailors. So the Memphis Belle is this tremendously important symbol for our country. And another, there's a lot of superlatives for the Memphis Belle, but you know, there were two movies made about this airplane. One made during the war, and then of course the movie made in 1990. So I can't think of many airplanes that have had two movies made about them. So our subject tonight is about the 1990 Memphis Belle movie. You're gonna hear a lot of new information, some really interesting things, some kind of backstory things about the Memphis Belle movie. And I'm really looking forward to hearing what our special guests have to say. So let me first introduce our two guests that we have. We have the director of the 1990 Memphis Belle movie. And Michael, if you'd like to come out on stage. And then we also have the co-producer of the movie, Catherine Weiler. Please help me welcome them. Please take a seat. Going to be, we're going to have kind of like a, kind of a discussion. We'll ask some questions. I'll moderate, and then at the end we'll have some Q&A for maybe about 15 or 20 minutes. So wonderful to have you both here. Catherine and I, we've known each other for a bit here when the Memphis Belle was being restored, and I'm very fortunate to finally meet Michael after all these years. But first big question I have is, how did this movie come about?
Well, I can tell you that. I was working for quite a wonderful British producer named David Putnam, who had come to Columbia Pictures, taken over the studio, and he hired me, and I showed him a documentary that I had recently made about my father, who was a movie director named William Wyler. And my father served in World War II making documentaries to help the war effort at home, and he made a documentary called The Memphis Belle. So when David Putnam saw my documentary, he wanted to see the Memphis Belle documentary, and then he had this idea, which I certainly thought was brilliant, to make a feature film about Memphis Belle. And that's how it all began.
And Michael, how did you get involved?
I was a young filmmaker in England. I'd made one film, and I was very keen on American film at that point. I'd done a lot of study. And David came back, and he was like the big producer in Britain. And he came back, and he was looking for who was the new young thing, basically. And that happened to be me at the time. So I was very lucky in that way. But he sent me the script, and I read it, and I thought, this is just kind of like a John Ford movie. You know, it was just ordinary people that I could relate to. You know, even though I was Scottish and I wasn't anything to do with the Second World War, I could relate to the youth of the people involved and the nature of the story. I mean, it was just, to me, it was very obvious, and I thought straight away I was very lucky to get involved in it.
That's wonderful. So, we have two empty seats here. I think we have some other special guests. So if you could all help me welcome Tate Donovan and Reed Diamond, who were two of the actors in the movie.
Come on.
have got away with that with me.
Hi.
Hi.
Hello.
So Tate played the pilot, and Reed played the top turret gunner, the flight engineer.
Co-pilot. I played the co-pilot.
Oh, that's right. Co-pilot.
Yeah. I wanted to be the pilot.
That's
but
right. Yeah.
There was Matthew Modine.
There was an aircraft commander. So
yes.
So, gentlemen, could you talk a little bit about your parts in the movie?
Yeah. Well,
I played the co-pilot, Luke Sinclair, and want to thank Michael Caton Jones for casting me, because it was one of the great jobs I ever had. It was amazing. Getting to work with him and Catherine and, you know, that legacy of her dad. And it was just a special movie right off the bat. I was like, everybody who auditioned for it was like, oh, man, I want to get this.
Yeah, it was a life-changing. It was my first movie. And I played Virgil Hoogesteeger, the top turret gunner, flight engineer. And to this day, we still all call each other by our character names. That's how important this movie was to us. So anytime Eric calls me, he's like, Hoogesteeger Meisterburger. I was Virgil the Virgin. Just if if I define myself in the show, I was the Virgin of the show. And we should go.
No.
Where's the Jeep?
We gotta get the Jeep.
But it was a life-changing. If I could just, it was a life-changing job for all of us. It was, and for me, it was like I was saying to Michael earlier. It was all downhill after this. To have your first movie, and I don't know if you guys have talked about this, but we were the only second. We did a boot camp when we first got there. We had like a week in London getting our clothes together and meeting everyone, and then we went to boot camp for a week. And at the time, the only other movie that had done a boot camp was Platoon. And that was led by Dale Dye, who went on to become an actor, Oliver Stone movie. And we were at Fulford Manor in Devon, Lord Fulford's Manor, and we did a boot camp with a bunch of ex-Royal Marines or possibly current SAS guys. And I don't know that they knew that we all needed to be camera ready at the end of boot camp, but it was, of the many genius ideas that Michael Caton Jones had, about casting and how we were treated, boot camp was spectacular. And the reason I'm still friends with this guy and Eric Stoltz to this day is during maneuvers one night in boot camp, the three of us shared a one-man tent.
That's how it was life-changing.
Yeah, it was life-changing. Yeah. Yeah.
So, Michael, so I have a question. That movie appeared to be very challenging to be able to make for many different reasons. Could you talk about some of the challenges with making a movie like that?
Yeah, well, there were a whole bunch of different challenges, which because I was young and didn't know any better, I didn't take much notice of. One of the main difficulties that I felt was, how are we going to tell these guys apart? Something as simple as that. You have 10 guys with their faces covered half the time. So first you cast them, and when you've got an ensemble, you really are trying to get them to behave equally. One of the things is, sorry, I'm going to jump all over the place, but when I met the real guys who flew the Memphis Belle, they came to see us before we shot, one of the most striking things I got out of them was how down to earth they were and how normal and how they tried to explain that it was teamwork more than anything else that was important. That you were only as strong as your weakest link. That's how they felt about the whole thing. And it just dawned on me that that was the way that I had to go with these guys. I had to try and form them into a group, one way or the other, to make them perform better. Because when you know someone, you behave physically quite different with them and the way you talk to them and what have you. And we had about a week to get that together, which is why they were sent to do quite hellish things to each other, because that gets you to know each other pretty quickly. And also you cast as close to the type of character you're after, because then they've got less distance to travel. They don't have to make a lot up. So, you know, Reed was very young and sweet, and Tate was very jealous of Matthew's acting ability.
I played the shallow guy who just wanted to be famous.
Yes.
Yeah.
So you kind of try and drag out elements of their character, but that was all because you're basically telling a story, and the story is about things that happened, not things that happened on the last mission, but things that happened somewhere to somebody at one point during the air war. So the idea was to pull in these incidents and try and give an audience an understanding of what the sheer hell of an environment was that they had to go through. Then there was the technical aspect of it, which was mixing real aeroplanes with studio sets, with models, with, you know, green screen, with whatever. There were a lot of things to try and blend together. And I'd never done any of this in my life before, so it was a learning process for me. And the last thing I needed was complaining actors. So I was pretty heavy on them to keep them out of the way. But you had to pre-visualize the entire film, because just to give you an idea of filming it, the inside of a B-17, if you've never seen it, is actually very tight. It's very cramped, and that was the first thing that I noticed when I went to see one. So I decided that I was going to try and give an audience a feeling of that compression. And there was a film, a German film, about a submarine called Das Boot, which had come out some years before, and you got a real feeling of claustrophobia. So I kind of felt that that's what one of the things I was going to try and emulate. So to do that, we had to basically build the entire interior of a B-17. Don't care about what it looked like from the outside, but on the inside. And then we had to split it into 10 sections. And we'd take one section and we'd put it on a gimbal, like a platform, with it had the hydraulics underneath it, so the thing could go like that. Now, the only way we could film that was from another platform with a camera on an arm, and it had to go up and down as this was going up and down. So, you know, the camera's going like that, and the actors are bouncing all over, and you couldn't get a shot half the time. It was very difficult in that way. But we persevered, and I made a decision. A 50mm lens is about that. It's about as much as you can see. It's what the eye sees. And you can go wider to make it to get things in, but that would kill the idea of making it compressed. So I kept under a 50mm lens, and it made it hell for the interior shoot, real hell. But we managed to get through it. But the one thing I'm most proud of is we only had 5 B-17s, and we've made it look as though we got a lot more. And we even crashed one at the time, which made it 4. So every shot you see, there's 4 planes in it. Every single one, they all look different. But that was a very challenging aspect of it. I'll pass you over to the actors now.
Yeah. So I was going to ask Catherine. So could you talk about your role in the movie as the co-producer?
Well, I would say that first of all, this was the first time I took on such a role. But I was very lucky that David Putnam, this really extraordinary producer who had made lots of films, including, of course, Chariots of Fire, he was the person I could go to with any questions, and he knew everything. But he was kind enough to basically sort of let me be in charge on the set. And he stayed away unless, you know, there was really something going on. And it was a learning experience while it was going on. And it was quite fascinating. And for me also, just to watch Michael work was a whole other, you know, I had grown up going on my father's sets and seeing his way of working. And here was another way. It was quite a fascinating experience.
So it was mentioned that you all got together with the original crew. Could you all talk about what that was like? It must have been incredible.
Yeah, it was amazing to meet the original co-pilot. He was a great guy, and they were just as thrilled to meet us and come back and see the plane and be amazed. We met him at an airfield, Duxford in England. And I mean, yeah, it was awesome, wasn't it?
Well, what was so cool, so funny story, because I almost went up in a B-25 today. So when we made the movie, they were doing, because one of the things that sets this movie apart, I think, and I feel so fortunate to have been a part of, is that there's no CGI, right? So we use real planes, and the aerial photography is really planes up in the air, and Messerschmitts are coming in, and people are firing blanks. And so we'd gotten out of boot camp, and we were all very hard. And I don't even know, one of Michael Caton Jones's genius moves, I don't know if you've mentioned, is after we left boot camp, we drove in a small van. It was an 8-person van for 10 guys, and we drove all the way up to the airfield in Lincolnshire, and we paraded in front of Michael Caton Jones, who was dressed as a general. So we were all like, well, we want to go up in a B-17 bomber, and they're like, no way. This is going to tie back to the original crew. They're like, no way, you cannot go. The insurance is not going to cover it. And we went to boot camp. We're tough. We need to go up in this thing. So they finally relented, and we went up, and it was amazing. And just to see the patchwork of England below, and the fire, the 50 cals, the Messerschmitts are coming in, was amazing. And then suddenly the guys showed up, the original guys, and they were there to have a party. And it doesn't matter now. I'm sure the statute of limitations has passed. They started flying that plane like crazy, right? So they were flying it. Did you flew it?
I flew in it, yeah.
But did you ever fly it?
Yeah, I got to ground reference.
Because I know that Matthew did. So they were flying the planes, and then it went from like no one can fly to like everyone and their girlfriend can fly until we crashed the French plane. So sorry, France. But I think the thing we took away, which I don't know if you talked about, and I think it's like one of the paramount themes of the movie, is that like, and you know, there's people here in this audience who obviously really did the thing, and I'll tell you a funny story about that. But it was like, what we learned is you're not brave for yourself, you're not brave to prove something, you're brave because you want to take care of your pals. And that's what it's about. It's about you taking care of your buddy and not letting your buddy down. And you'll do extraordinary things to not let your buddy down. And I really thought that was the heart of the movie that you brought out. Yeah. It was like this, you know, band of brothers, but it was, you know, this crew of 10 and taking care of themselves and the other planes around them and doing a horrible job, but showing up. And because I was talking to people in the B-25, and like, these guys were so brave. And they were like, and then she said, but the actual veterans never say, as these guys did, well, I wasn't brave, I just did my job. But I think your job was looking out for your buddy. And I think we really felt that camaraderie, to this day. So, you know, and can I just tell a quick story?
Oh, please do.
So on some level, we think we actually were in the Second World War, right? Okay, so we went to boot camp, and we paraded in front of Michael Caton Jones and David Strathairn and John Lithgow. And I wish DB was here tonight, because the movie had come out, and DB, so we thought we'd been in the Second World War. And so DB, I was doing a play in New York, and DB came to see the play, and we went out that night for drinks, as one does after the play. And the lead of the play was an older British gentleman who had actually flown Lancasters during the Second World War and had been shot down and spent much of the war in a German prisoner of war camp. And so we're just talking, because Memphis Belle is everything to us, and DB and I are telling our stories, and then Roy Dautry says, well, you know, I flew Lancasters during the war, and we both, without missing a beat, we said, but yeah, but you flew at night. And someone at the table turned to us, and they're like, you didn't fly at all. And we're like, right.
So it's interesting that you say that about that you guys felt like you were in the war, because when we were working on the restoration of the Memphis Belle, there's the outtakes from the movie, from the World War II movie, done by Catherine's father. There's about 12 hours of outtakes, color footage, and they only used about 40 minutes of it for the wartime movie. So you can actually see that footage. It's in the National Archives, but if you go to YouTube, all 34 reels, if you just search Memphis Belle outtakes. Well, in the restoration, we went through those outtakes frame by frame by frame, you know, days and weeks. Wow. I got to know who some of the people were, and it felt almost like being there, because and just seeing it so much and recognizing the faces and things like that. So it's just interesting that you guys had the same kind of experience. You felt like you were there somehow. Of course, none of us were, thank God. But so next question I have is in speaking of the wartime movie, you know, obviously that influenced the 1990 movie. Mm-hmm. Maybe you could talk about how the scenes and some of the ideas and shots and things like that.
Yeah, we had a very good writer who's passed away now, Monty Merrick, who was a terrific guy, and he, you know, it's a hidden part of this movie that he's managed to, you know, characterize 10 different people and to weave a story without resorting to cheap theatrics to keep the audience interested. But when I watched Kath Stad's film, you know, there was a grittiness about it, and I guess it's just a normality. You know, this is what they did every day. There was an inevitability about it that I thought I can take some of this stuff. I stole the idea for the takeoff sequence from him because he had a lot more planes, of course, and I had my four. But it was done in the editing room. It was cleverly done. But mainly, I think, you know, the it was really the tone of the piece. I mean, the difference between what he was doing and what I was doing is I had to make an entertainment. I had to make a story for people who were not interested in planes per se, you know. It had to appeal to everybody, and it had to appeal on an emotional level. So to do that, you have to kind of work differently. You have to tell a story, a much more detailed story, and you have to work with characters. But the sequencing, you know, and it became what every plane went through. You know, there was the waiting around, there was the takeoff, there was the getting into formation, there was starting off going across, there was leaving England, there was the first planes coming up, then the little friends leaving. All these things happened in a sequence, which he showed in his film. But I kind of broke it down for us with Monty about that we would do the same. We'd be doing it in sections. So structurally, I stole a lot from that. But mainly, a lot of it was just relentlessly trying to tell the story honestly. You know, not trying to jazz it up, not trying to do too much with it, just let the circumstances provide the drama.
Excellent. So I have a question. This is kind of for Reed, but it's kind of to the whole panel. Is the top turret gunner, that's the flight engineer, so that's the crew member that needs to know everything about the airplane. I mean, how all the systems work, and if something goes wrong, you know, the they're not just the top turret gunner, more importantly, they're the flight engineer. And the B-17 is an incredibly complex machine. I mean, it's unbelievable how complex that airplane is. It's easy for people to think, oh, that was a long time ago. You know, things are much more complex. That was very complex. So the question I have is, did you discover about how complex these machines were? Was that new to you when you started becoming familiar with the B-17? I mean, whether it be as the flight engineer or for the whole panel, to understand that these are really complex machines. Brilliant people designed them, and they were difficult to operate, and it's much more complex than it might appear on the surface. Mm-hmm. Did you discover that?
Well, there's a lot of things that I think that we discovered about these planes. I mean, what's remarkable about them is the engineering is incredible, but it's also this analog world where you've got just wires pulling things that are running through the entire plane. I mean, but I think for me, the thing that I remember being most shocked about being on the plane was how thin the skin was. And it was interesting, because I climbed into that B-25 today, and it's much smaller, much more compact than the B-17. I was like, the bravery, you know, that we were talking about, just the to get into that plane and go up. It's hard enough to go up just for a joyride, let alone having people shoot at you. But also the fact that, obviously, the technology was, you know, it's all mechanical. It's you can all touch it and feel it and work with it, and also they still fly to this day, which is amazing, right?
Yeah.
And so I mean, it's an amazing, you know, amazing and awesome and, you know, piece of machinery for sure. And I mean, I didn't repair it. It wasn't quiet, you know. That was all acting, because I had to, like, I'd stand back there and I'd pretend like, okay, what I'd be focusing on, and I'd ask one of the real guys, like, what would you be looking at? He's like, I'd be looking at that dial. I'm like, okay, I'll look at that dial and look at that, and then we're just pretending. I'm like, that thing does the jigma jig does that, and the jigma jig does that. But most of the time too, because we shot in sections, I had to do leg acting for a month. Yeah. Do you remember? But it was like, that was the best part, is because I'm just in the top turret just going, and all you're seeing is this. But we were on, because you put the microphones into the oxygen mask, it was great. Because for the first week I was there, I didn't talk because I was so nervous, because it was my first, as you said, like for the first week I didn't talk, and then for the rest of the time I never shut up. And it was great. So I could just be in the top turret cracking jokes. But no, I felt like, you know, the best part about being the flight engineer is you felt like that love for the plane, like it was my responsibility, because we all had our little character things mm-hmm, that we mm-hmm, wanted to do. Mm-hmm. Like you wanted to shoot a plane down.
Yeah.
I wanted to make sure she got home, and Neil was in love with his gun.
Yeah.
Yes,
yeah,
so that was his whole thing. He had a name for his gun, yeah, and he would hug it every day and kiss it.
Yeah. Yes. But when we went up and flew in them, I mean, the way it rattles, you know, they were like, you know, getting your seat and, you know, strap in and don't, you know, go out into the nose cone. But I was like, no one was around, so I just went out into that nose cone because I just wanted to experience, you know, taking off with the ground underneath you and just, you know. So I went out into that thing, but I was just like thrown around, you know, it's like crazy. And so I finally got into the seat, and then they let me ground reference, which is they put me in the driver's seat, and they said, see that barn? And I'm like, yeah. And he said, okay, turn around that barn and just, you know, slowly move that thing. So I move the steering wheel. I don't even know what it is. I'm so sorry. I am so sorry.
We should go.
That I got to fly a B-17 and that you guys didn't is there's no justice in this world. No. So I fly the steering wheel. And about 30 seconds later, I'm like, I think this thing is broken or something like that. And then all of a sudden, we started really turning. And I was like, oh my God, how do I? And they're like, it's okay, don't worry about it. But it was like flying a giant Buick, you know, that had suspension problems.
So I have a question about some of the emotions while you were working on this whole project. And the question I have is, did any of you have moments where you were overcome? And the reason why I ask that question is, when we were doing research on the Memphis Belle, we went to the National Archives and went through combat reports. Every crew, when they came back, they were debriefed. All those reports are in the National Archives. And there were times I was trying to get information, and I'm, you know, one sheet, next sheet, didn't return. I recognized the names. It's like seeing the footage, knowing who was going to die. And there were times I was, because I was doing research, it wasn't kind of real. And then moments it was, these are real people that didn't come back. And there were many, so many. And there were moments I would just get overwhelmed and just stop for a moment because there was so much death.
Yeah.
Did any of you have any experiences similar to that as you were working in this project?
The only one I had close to that was when I came up with the idea for the sequence of reading the letters. We had the idea that the base commander was going to read, you know, a letter that he had to write to a family talking about how their son died. And when we were talking about that, Monty and I, we came across a whole pile of different letters that were various ones that were the same. And it was extremely emotional reading these things, really heartfelt. You understood that there was a family behind each person and the effect that was going to have. And I felt it was worth breaking the fourth wall in the movie to go from this is a fiction, this is, you know, you're in the cinema, to actually real footage of real planes being shot down with real stories being read out over that with a piece of music. Because I wanted to just take you out this story and then bring you back in. But that was the only time that I really felt, you know, emotionally connected to that. The rest of the time, I was just trying to get these guys, it was like wrestling cats. You know? I just wanted to get to the end of the day every day.
For the record, in that stretch, in that scene, in that mm-hmm. I get overcome mm-hmm. because it's a German fighter gun camera footage mm-hmm. and it's real and you know that people are dying.
Yeah.
And it's a incredibly effective moment in the movie. So did any of you others have any similar experiences? I mean, it's your family,
for you, Catherine?
Well, I would say, just sort of related to my whole feeling about the film, my father lost his hearing during the war because he was 40 when he went into the Air Force, and he went in to make documentaries to help the war effort at home, help people at home understand what their sons were going through. And so my whole childhood and family life was very much impacted by the fact that Daddy could only hear out of one ear, and that ear too was a little bad. So, like, for example, every night, who got to sit on Daddy's good ear at dinner? You know, I just had such a feeling in me about making it all understandable to, you know, so many generations later, what by that this time it was what their grandfather or more had gone through. And I thought that Michael and the guys did a great job making that understandable to the viewing public.
Yeah, it's anecdotal, but I when the Memphis Belle first came to the National Museum of the U.S. Air Force in 2005, I have a niece who surely would not pick up the 500-page, you know, history of the strategic bombing campaign in Europe, but she just got super excited. She says, "My favorite movie," mm-hmm. and it dawned on me in that moment that this 1990 movie brings that story to millions of people that mm-hmm. otherwise would not be familiar with it. And it has all the important parts, the danger, the importance of what they were doing, the camaraderie, all those things. And so it literally was like a light bulb went over my head that this is for my niece, this is the way she gets that story. And without that movie, doesn't happen. So certainly it was effective in that case with my niece.
Well, I also think it's a real responsibility of the filmmakers to not cheapen things, you know. As I say, you can do cheap theatrics, jump scares, get people leaping up in the cinema. It's not actually very complicated to do that. It's much more important that you maintain a discipline about the morality of what you're shooting. You know, that you try and reflect honestly what people went through. And I mock them, but I had a fantastic group of actors who really gave it all for it and, you know, worked really hard. And it's a film we're all extremely proud of, and that we were able to make something that could communicate to people who didn't care about airplanes, mm-hmm. you know.
So I didn't, Dennis, do you two have any sobering moments, any of those realizations as you were going through the project?
Well, having Catherine on set every day really was, not only because her dad was such an amazing filmmaker, but for me, I just remember having you there sort of was like, oh yeah, this really happened. You know, like these guys, you know, her dad was really there. And these guys really, it just sort of made it all very real. It was really important, you know. That was a great move on Putnam's part, mm-hmm. to put you, you know, on that set every day. Because we all were like, oh yeah, wow. This really did happen, because, you know, we were lost in our having a fantastic time, generally.
And I think in, to echo what Michael said, I think we felt a real responsibility to honor the people who actually did the job, right? And then I think there was never a second where we didn't think about that, and we were very lucky too, because I don't know. They sent us before, we didn't audition initially, we first had meetings with Michael, and you guys sent a VHS copy of your dad's movie. So before, like, and I, it was amazing, like the night before I met Michael, and did you see?
Yeah.
And they sent us a VHS copy of your dad's movie, and it was spectacular. And I remember seeing bits of it and knowing a bit about it before, but that was such a great way to then go in. And I mean, because that movie, I just rewatched it. I think we were watching it, my wife and I were watching it like a month ago, I think, or just because it's just amazing. Just that, you know, because you were like, oh, he's shooting that while it's happening.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So, yeah. Yeah, to mention, kind of piggyback on that, so those of you that might not be familiar, Catherine's dad, William Wyler, actually flew 5 combat missions. He was on the Memphis Belle when the crew finished their 25th mission, so he was on the airplane, and so he was taking the same risks that the air crews were taking, and only 28% of the air crews finished their 25 missions during this span. And actually, one of the cameramen that was on William Wyler's crew was killed on a mission. Harold Tannenbaum. He was like 41 years old, killed. So her dad was taking those risks, and to show that what value he placed on his service to our country, there's an incredible picture of his office, and he has Academy Awards on a shelf, and next to it he has his medals that he was awarded during the war, that he valued his service to the nation to that degree. I just find that absolutely incredible. So another question about the movie, are there any Easter eggs or kind of things that a viewer might not notice that were placed in the movie, that some, or things that people should pay attention that they might miss?
Well, obviously we had a hobbit. And you didn't know, but we all did. Yes. Yes.
Yeah, there's a sequence at the beginning of the picture where a plane comes in and belly lands and blows up and kills them all. Well, I had to get a reaction shot out of the boys when they were watching this thing happen. And they were all going, oh. And it just wasn't convincing. So I got the effects guys to rig up an explosion, I guess, behind the camera. And I was going to give them the cue when to do it. So they're all standing there, and I gave them the cue, and the thing went off. It almost blew my ear off. They jumped like 5 feet in air, but also the cameraman did. And you'll notice the camera goes like that. It's because I'd forgotten to tell him that it was going to happen. It was going to happen. I couldn't hear for the day after that. I really did my ears in.
So are there any other things in the movie, little things that were done, or Easter eggs in the movie?
Well, there's just tons of stories. Mm-hmm. One that comes to mind is there's a scene where I go back, and I shouldn't go back, to the tail gun, and I go back and I shoot a plane down, and it slices into one of our planes, and the whole plane dies, and I feel I'm racked with guilt as I climb back to my co-pilot seat. And it was supposed to be a really emotional scene, and I was a young actor, and I just spent like the whole day we were supposed to shoot that. I was just freaking out and emotional and just, you know, really worried about that scene. And I came out for the first take, and I've got tears in my eyes, and I'm hysterical. And Michael Caton Jones, he just is like, all right, cut, 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 cut. And he's like, what are you doing? And I'm like, oh, I just killed him. And he's like, wait, just crawl out of the plane and just do what I say. And I'm like, okay. And so I crawl out of the plane, and he goes, look up, look to your right, look down, look ahead, cut. All right, let's move on. And I was like, it was my big moment, and all I'm doing is going this, going that, going that, going that.
I thought I was the only one who got that direction.
Really?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, he was famous for just like, you know, we actors were always trying to be, you know, super emotional, and he was just like, oh my God, give me a break.
Take out the pauses.
Yeah.
So on the subject of that, the airplane thing was called Mother and Country, the one that got cut in half.
Yeah.
So do you know if that part of the story was influenced by a B-17 called All American that was almost cut in half? So, okay.
I don't.
There's a famous picture of a B-17, and in fact it was a BF-109, just like in the movie, mm-hmm. had been a hit, and it almost took the tail off mm-hmm. in the same spot as Mother and Country, mm-hmm. but it didn't quite cut it in half, yeah. and it was able to make it back. So the airplane's called All American. It's kind of
we referenced a lot of footage. Anything we found, we tried to match it to that. You know, if we were going to copy stuff, so it's very possible that we did actually rip something else off.
Yeah, I mean that was an event that happened. Yeah. So, but they survived in the case of All American. So you guys had talked about having to go through military courses. Could you tell us about some of the crazy things you had to do to get ready or to go through it?
Well, do you remember when you came and visited us, Catherine? We were at the shooting range. We're near the end of boot camp.
Oh yeah.
Because the thing was boot camp. So you know, we have 10 actors of various stages of their career. Some had been there established for a long time, and some like myself were just beginning. And we get sent to this boot camp, and there is no frills. And that was part of the genius of Michael Caton Jones, was creating sort of a hardship so we would bond. For example, often when you go to a wardrobe fitting, when you get your costume in a show, you get to, oh yeah, there's racks of clothes, and you're like, oh, I like that, I don't like that. He was like, this is what you're wearing, and that's it. And you know, so it was assigned to us, and then we went to this boot camp, which, like I say, was quite arduous. But we bonded there, because do you remember planning all the escapes that we were gonna do? We had so many, because we were like, we shouldn't be here, we're gonna get out of here. So Matthew, right. The different ringleaders that we'd plan, like, we're gonna hijack a boat, and we're gonna sail up the coast of England, and blah, blah, blah. But we really did bond. And it was amazing, because it was emotional. We spent all the time marching and doing maneuvers through the nights. And to your credit, I noticed it while we were in boot camp, like every character was in the actor. So Courtney would be like, I can't do it, man. And I'm like, come on, we're like, come on, get up, man. And you know, the people who were sort of the shirkers were the shirkers, the people who were committed were committed. And we went one day to a shooting range, and you were terrified, because we just were like quiet and like had a 1,000-yard just death stare. Remember that?
Yeah.
And yes, but it all worked out. The proof was in the pudding. It all translated to the film.
Well, I did think that whole idea of the boot camp was just so brilliant, because a bunch of actors come from L.A. and all of a sudden they're in the Air Force, and it just made everybody understand where you were.
Yeah. And it created a camaraderie that then translated in the film. Like, talk about Easter eggs. I don't know because obviously we stuck to the script, but there were little moments that then Michael would catch, like The Amazing Grace, when we're singing that on the Jeep. We just started singing together, because Harry would always have us singing. We'd all do sing-alongs, right? Because I don't know if Harry Connick Jr. is kind of musical. And so we would start singing. That was one of our bonding things. And you heard us do it, and you're like, do it on the Jeep. And then it became a thing, and then they put it in, it ended up into the score and stuff like that. So those were those little things, just because we really did have a relationship. Because that's the thing, that's the hardest thing. Not the hardest thing, it's not very hard what we do. But like, you have to create relationships, and as if you've been through something very quickly, and it has to be convincing, for the movie. And that boot camp was genius. And by the end, we all were bonded, and we'd been through a lot, and then
we still are.
We still are loving.
So with that bonding, was there at any point where you were interacting with each other as your characters, even when you weren't in character? Like, was Matt Modine, as the aircraft commander, was in charge of the airplane? Were there ever moments where you guys fell into that?
Well, Matt was, his career was much bigger than ours at the time, so he was sort of a natural authority figure.
Right.
Definitely, we all sort of like looked up to him and listened to him and wanted time with him. He was definitely the head honcho. But I remember Eric Stoltz. He was like a method actor at the time, and his character's name was Danny, and we had to call him 24 hours a day, for 3 months, Danny. And I would forget, and I'd be at a pub and I'd be like, Eric, and he'd be like, and then you'd be like, Danny, and he'd be like, yes. And I was like, oh God. I was like, forget it, I don't even want to talk to you anymore.
But the idea of sending the actors away really paid enormous dividends. Like I say, they're very good actors, but you when you know someone, as a human being, you're judging when you meet someone, or you're looking at someone, or what's going on, a lot of the time by their body language, by how they relate to each other. And you can't invent closeness. You can sort of pretend a bit, but you can't invent a kind of shared experience as quickly as we needed to do. We needed to make them feel like a team. And the one thing you take out of that is you believe that they all know each other really well. you know, and they're all very at ease in each other's company. And it was forged in this one week. I was getting nightly reports about who was doing what.
Neil almost burned down Fulford Manor.
Talk a little bit about Dorian the original movie, because that's a wonderful companion piece.
Right, and I should have gone back and looked into that and reminded myself of it. I can't give you details about it.
So there's this amazing, if you haven't seen it yet, that original footage, that 12 hours of footage, Catherine and some other folks worked to have that restored, that footage restored. It's all color footage, but it had faded somewhat from the war and so on, and the restoration is absolutely brilliant, and they restored the original wartime movie to where you can see things that you can't see in the movie. The detail is so incredible. And then there's kind of a documentary about what the crews went through called The Cold Blue, so I definitely would recommend checking that out. It's really amazing. So if you're fascinated by the wartime movie and the 1990 movie, that's another great companion piece to see there. So what, with that military training, what was the worst thing you had to do of all of it?
I don't know, it was like walking through mud. We had to carry Courtney Gaines, wasn't it?
We did, and we had to swim across the pond in the morning,
mud.
In front of Fulford Manor. Yeah. I remember,
it was just like 10 guys in this big room on cots and waking us up at, 5 o'clock in the morning.
Sweat, lambing pants, and we'd march all day. We'd have to march and we'd have to drill, and then we'd do overnight maneuvers.
Yeah.
But it was hard, and it was.
This
long.
Was your boot camp.
This was boot camp. Yeah. That's what you asked about, correct?
Yes.
Yeah. And we had to poop in the woods. And then interesting too, because they told us how you had to clean yourself up in the British Army, and that just didn't make sense to me what they were suggesting, because they had this, like, you got one sheet of toilet paper and it was like you had to use it for lots of different things, and I thought that's not gonna happen.
We're Americans.
We're Americans, damn it. We use the whole roll. But we really did bond, and we went crazy. Like I say, like at one point we're on our last, the night that we all shared, that Tate and Eric and I shared the one-man tent, we were on maneuvers. And we'd do an all-night march, and they'd give us AK-47s with blanks, and they'd throw, flashbangs at us
as we're
marching through the night. And at one point, Neil had taken it too seriously, because it was like us against them. So it was gonna be like the Memphis Belle against these guys. And luckily, one of them, was it Ronnie, the really handsome one? He found Neil, who had siphoned off all the gasoline from one car, and he'd made two Molotov cocktails, and he was almost going to burn down the 500-year-old manor. But we
oh my God,
we escaped.
It was crazy.
It's good times. My favorite part about Lord Fulford's manor, do you mind if I digress for a moment? Is Lord Fulford, his family had been on the wrong side of the English Civil War. So they had this amazing manor, and it was all filled with like broken battle flags. And I remember the first day we got there. Do you remember the first day we got there? And
no.
What he said to you and DB, he's like, I know some of you Americans are very sympathetic to the Irish, but we'll have none of that here. And you and DB were like, oh, DB Sweeney and Tate Donovan. But he would have shooting parties all day, and it was like his friends would come over, and they would think it was like a Monty Python skit, and they'd just drink and shoot. And then one day we got to shoot, which was great.
Yeah,
did you shoot the ski?
Yeah.
So it was amazing. That's how we bonded.
You're supposed to make it seem tough and hard.
It was tough.
All you talk about is Lord Brantford.
Well, we got to tell the fun stories. I did have an adder swim over my back the
a
first
what?
Day. An adder?
Oh, really?
I didn't know they
a
had
snake?
Adders. It was in the pond.
Oh,
there,
my God.
Yeah, sure. But,
So speaking of shooting, could you perhaps talk about the shooting schedule, how long it was, and how did it go, and were there any
I can't
any
even remember
hiccups
how long.
Or
no, it basically broke down that we did the exterior stuff at the airport first, so there was maybe a 3-week chunk. We flew the I think 4 B-17s we flew from the States, and they went the old route from you know, Nova Scotia, Greenland, Iceland, Scotland, and down. And they all arrived at the same time, which was quite incredible. But we, you know, we shot the outside, and it, you know, we had like 200 extras, 300 extras a day, and planes flying. It was a huge coordination job, which I had a very, very good British crew to do. And then we went inside the studio, and we were in there for a good long while. It was hard. It was hard. For what I had mentioned before about this lens size and just the difficulty of getting in there, you know, it was a heat wave that summer, and the only, you know, the actors would be sitting there and they've got like five layers on and they'd start to sweat, so we'd have to get a ladder and put the makeup woman would run up, dab the sweat, and she'd have to come back down, take the ladder away, and then put the camera back in, and then the sweat's beginning to come again. You know, so that was happening all the time. You had to turn over, you get one take, bang, okay, get in there and tidy them up. You know, you just are in a grind situation at that point. You just got to grind it through. The film was not in any shape whatsoever, maybe a week before filming ended. Normally you can get an assembly and you can see if a story's working or not. But because of the nature of this, that nobody was in the same place, it only ever worked when the scenes were cut together in the aeroplane. So even a week before we finished, I don't know if this thing was going to be a mess or whatever. Mm. I mean, I just thought it could be a disaster. You wouldn't know yet. But then you start working on the sound of it, and especially the soundtrack. And I you know, it was a good piece of casting getting Harry Connick. And then, as they said, using Londonderry Air as a kind of emotional through line on the music, you know, that he would sing it at one point, it would be repeated somewhere else, and then we could make it orchestral. And the music towards the end really, really enhances the whole climax of the film. And a lot of these things, they come to you, it's a process. The things just happen, and if you're aware and awake, you can snatch it out there. But the actual shooting is, to be honest, just a bit of a grind on this one, because you had to get the line, you know, and that was it. You just moved on, you know.
So it's getting all the pieces without knowing exactly what it's finally going
to
be.
You just hope. You know, they say a film directed by it should be a film hoped by, because you're hoping it's going to work. You're hoping this is going to go together. And you never really know. And you get it in the neck. They don't get it in the neck. They just say, well, I just did what you said.
You told me an amazing story about editing. You know, when you got in the editing room, it was so brilliantly shot and put together, and you had such great footage that you realized it looked fake because it was too...
Yeah, the you know, we'd sit in dailies in the morning, and the camera crew from the airplane unit would come back and we'd look at what they'd shot, and you've got a blue sky and you've got that for 3 minutes and you're sitting there and nothing's happening and you're and then suddenly a little black dot comes straight past you and you go, okay, so that's the bit we're using. And after about a month or so of this, we've got a film about that long, and it was balletic, and you know, it was big feeling, but it wasn't. It didn't make you feel as though there was any action. And we had one unit that went up with a B-17, and the guy had a camera in it, handheld. He was shooting from plane to plane, and he overexposed the film. The film came back and it had been fogged, and we looked at it, and suddenly, all of a sudden, this stuff actually felt real. It felt like a documentary. So we started cutting that in, and then realizing that it was actually the camera movement and the flaws in it that made it work. We went back and we started shaking all the other film and putting flashes in. And it really, you can see when you see these sequences of them being attacked, it starts off a little smooth, and then we started going into that just to make it escalate and to come out of nowhere. And it worked really well, but that was something we discovered when you're panicked because it's not working. What are we going to do?
Yeah, that's really interesting, because that, I mean, you get the very same thing happens in the wartime movie with the footage, because they're getting shot at and they can't, and the plane's shaking and vibrating and all that, and it just, I think that's really effective because that's what happened.
And you say Easter, you say eggs. I suddenly remembered, of course, towards the end of the shoot, DB was miserable because he was one of the last actors left and he wanted to get out of there. He didn't want to be hanging around. And he was such a pain in the ass. So, really, so we had to do the scene where we were diving. And he's, and you know, we had to shake the thing really bad. So I said, like, shake it. Give it a good shake. And we did it. And he was bouncing all over the place. And he loved it. I kept doing it for about 5 minutes. And he was going, oh, God, the hell with this. Okay. So when you see it, you'll see him falling all over the plane. And you'll hear me groaning from outside.
So I noticed you talked about that there were four B-17s. I noticed in the movie that there's the German fighters, the BF-109s, mm-hmm. are actually Spanish. Mm-hmm. How was that arranged to get, and how many of those were involved?
I can't remember, to be honest. We were trying to get planes from everywhere at that stage, and the Spanish Air Force had three or four, I think, something like that. And we had some P-51s, which we doubled up. You know, and with the nose art on the B-17s, we would put something on alternate sites, you know, so that it could look as though, you know, if I sent it that way through frame, it was that plane, and if it turned around and came back, it was another one. As I said, a lot of the time you're looking at the footage on a cinema screen and it's just a black dot. So we found that we could actually cheat, you know, other planes in there, unless you were really focusing on what they were supposed to be. Like if they were supposed to be P-51s going away, you had to use them. But for fighters in the distance, we could get away with using them as Germans as well.
Would you say that this is kind of one of the last of the big aviation movies before CGI?
Yeah, absolutely. It was right on the cusp of computer technology. There are shots in the film, and you know, some of the shots are a bit creaky now, but strangely enough, real shots of real planes flying through clouds look like models, but they were actually the real thing. I know the air coordinator was terrified at some of the stuff we were trying to do, you know, because I was in the B-25, you know, and we had the camera, we were flying below the B-17, and you couldn't see. They couldn't see each other, so it was actually very dangerous going with flying, following it into a cloud and what have you. But I was naive and, you know, not sure you can do that.
Yeah, well, I mean, we lost a number of heavy bombers when they collided in the clouds and they were forming up. Yeah. So it was very dangerous. No. So going to the cast, were there any special relationships or kind of groups that formed among the actors that you guys became, you know, really good friends, or was the whole crew coherent?
I think the whole crew was coherent. I really do. You know, obviously some paired off because they liked each other more, but in general they all did stuff together. It was a very successful idea, I have to say. I mean, these two are still talking. You know, to each other, so something what?
So with the casting, could you all talk a little bit about how some of the choices, like specific actors for specific positions or specific roles?
Well, you know, for the ball turret, you had to get a hobbit because you know there was nothing else, no one else could fit in there. and Sean was short at the time. I needed someone from the South who was musical, and Harry Connick hadn't acted before, but I knew the character was not going to tax him too much. And the rest of the time, you want to get just extremely good actors. You're trying to put in people who are, I wouldn't say amateur, but who are less experienced with experience. A combination of experience and enthusiasm works for a film crew as well as the cast. So you're looking at the character of the person as well as the abilities that they've got. But to be honest, you're mainly guided by the characterization in the screenplay. that was more important to telling the story than their technical ability on a plane.
Okay, so I'm going to ask each of you the same question, and then we can go to the question and answer session, and Chris Henry will have a microphone out. But the question that I have for each of you is that what does this movie mean to you, and why is it important to you? So I'll start with you, Michael.
At this stage of my life, it is one of the more fantastic memories of filming that I have. I really enjoyed making it. I was young and I was learning, and I achieved the kind of film that I had tried to make. I'm proud that it represents the group that it was intended to, you know. I'm also proud that it has managed to inspire a lot of people. A lot of young kids watched it and really have loved it through their lives. I mean, you know, there's nothing more that you can ask for as a director, that you make something and it affects people emotionally. So I have extraordinarily fond memories of it, and I think it's important as you were saying earlier in your introduction, as a symbol of what these people went through. And a specific period in time, and it shouldn't be forgotten just because it's not Top Gun-ish or it's not testosterone filled. It's really just normal people trying to cope with terrible, extraordinary circumstances.
Catherine, so what's important and meaningful to you?
On a certain level, I was terrified all the way through because I was having the gall to not remake, but somehow do something more with one of my father's films, and who was I to be doing that, etc. And I've always felt hugely grateful to Michael and these people and everybody really who turned out such a good film that made it okay that I had the idea in the first place.
I think something that you touched on was I sort of realized I love this film because of the story of teamwork, and I realized that I really love when I'm working to be part of a cast, mm-hmm. to be part of a team, is really just when I'm most joyous, and I think, you know, the film is about teamwork and surviving. You all need each other, and so I think that's the most impactful part of it for me.
And Reed?
Yeah, I mean, purely from just a very selfish point of view, I mean, it was the single greatest creative experience I've ever had in my career. It was my first film, and it was perfect, and it ruined me for a long time, because it was nothing was gonna be as good. Like, just the subject matter, the people I got to work with, the relationships that I have to this day, to be part of something so epic, to tell such an incredible story, to have such an incredible experience, to shoot it, Pinewood Studios, which is the studio that I dreamed my entire life of working at, for my first film, it was perfect creatively from beginning to end, and it was one of the most significant experiences of my entire life. So, and creatively, without question. So, yeah.
So it makes me think of one more question. You kind of touched on this, Michael. So I might be asking the same question again. But what is the legacy of this movie? What is the long-term legacy? 50 years from now. What is the legacy of it, you think?
I have no idea. As Kathy says, you're making something, you're just hoping it doesn't suck. you start out from such a low bar. To get out of it alive was enough for me. It stops becoming yours at that point. It becomes the audience's. It becomes whatever they want it to be. So I have no feelings. I have my personal feelings in relation to the making of it, but I'm completely clueless about what it means to other people. It really would have to, an audience would have to tell you. No.
Catherine?
I have nothing to add to that.
No.
I have one thing to add. One of the legacies is I'm coming here and meeting all y'all who know so much. I mean, yeah. mechanics who still know how to fix B-17s, you know, who were made, you know, before their grandfathers were born. I mean, it's sort of like, it's so inspiring to me to meet these people who care so much about aviation and just really respect the beauty and the craftsmanship and the ingenuity and the engineering behind it all. It's so inspiring me, and I'm like, I can't believe I was like, people come up to me and go, oh, mm-hmm. you inspired me to go into aviation. Yes. You know, I'm like, really? You know, that's incredible. That's amazing.
Yeah, just to dovetail on that. I mean, I think for me, what the most significant thing about it is kids saying, oh, I watched that movie with my father, or I watched that movie with my grandfather, and how many people wanted to share this with their kid or their grandkid, this movie, and that how important that experience was, that multi-generational sharing of this film. And to say, like, well, I went through this, or it's just, people say, oh, my grandfather just loved this movie, and he would show it with me, or my dad. And so, I worked with an actress who, she said, I was going through a really rough time in my life, and my father loved this movie, and she would just keep it on a loop and watch it every night, like, as a teenager, to get through that period.
Is she alive today?
She's doing great. She's doing, she has an amazing career. And, yeah. Okay, can I tell you one funny story about people watching Memphis Belle?
Yes, please do.
Okay, just one. It'll be quick.
That's what
we're here
for.
Quick one. So the movie had come out and we loved it. I was just so exciting. In fact, the first time I saw it, because it was my first movie, we had that incredible premiere at Leicester Square?
Leicester Square.
At Leicester Square. And we had a royal premiere. We had Princess Michael of Kent, who's now in some disrepute. But and it's the biggest screen, and we're having things. And I remember at the end of the movie, and then someone said to me, what'd you think? I was like, well, you couldn't hear me. And they're like, you couldn't hear you? What are you talking about? And I realized my heart was beating so hard every time I was on screen because I was so embarrassed to see myself up there. But that's not the funny story. The funny story is I met this guy after this movie came out. He's like, oh, I saw that movie. I hated it. And I'm like, really? He's like, yeah, I saw it on a plane. Now, this was the early 90s. That was when they only showed one movie on the plane that everyone had to watch. And I said, you saw it on a plane? And he's like, yeah. I go, how long was it? He's like, 45 minutes. Because they cut out all of the plane in distress parts from the movie. Right. So it was like, it made no sense. Because you can't show any danger. You can't show planes crashing. And so he'd seen a 45-minute version on United Airlines. And I was like,
could y'all talk a little bit more about how, so the rolling out the film when there was the premiere, were there international, there important guests and things like that? How did that play out?
Well, it's no great surprise. At that point, David Putnam wasn't Sir David. He was very keen on being knighted. It was his thing. And I came back I was working on another film, and I came back from the States, and he was really unhappy that I was getting to meet the Princess Michael instead of him. The joke used to be, if anyone picks up a butter knife, David gets down on one knee, you know. he was a great producer, I gotta say, you know. But he had that one weakness.
I guess we can start with the Q&As. Is Chris out there?
I'm backstage.
Awesome.
Yep. First question is, first off, thank you all for being here. And someone has asked, has the movie and its legacy inspired any of yourselves, relatives, or friends to pursue flying or any part of aviation?
To be honest, I was I was terrified of flying before I made the film, and I kind of got offered it and thought, oh, geez, what am I going to do? It kind of cured me, but I think getting out of it alive was a success. So I had no idea, no desire to get back up on a plane. I find them very dangerous. I admire you people, but I find them very dangerous myself. So no.
Is there any other questions?
Next question, Jeff. Do you each have a favorite line from the movie?
Let's see. Tomato soup is a good
soup,
one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Classic. Yeah.
What else? Anything?
Well, we have some lines that didn't make it. We were just talking about backstage.
The poem is pretty good. I love the poem that Eric reads. I think that's beautiful. And I love that in the script that, you know, we all think that he wrote it.
Yates.
Yates.
I got a lot of hamburger stuff, which is, and it's somewhat euphemistic at times, but it goes over my head, so I work the meat.
Did any of the original Memphis Belle crew come to see the premiere?
Yeah.
I feel like they, yeah.
Right? I don't either.
No, I don't think so. I don't think they
did the captain, the guy who was,
I don't think so. We're not sure.
They were too hungover from coming to visit the set, I think.
And we were still drunk.
What was the interaction like when the original cast came to visit the set, or the original crew came to visit the set?
I think we talked about that,
They were psyched.
They were psyched to be there. We were psyched to have them there.
Yeah, it was really fun.
You can see it. There's a great. I was just looking at the photo of the generations of them behind us, and they're holding on. Your guys holding on to you, and Robert Wright's holding on to Matt. Like there was like we bonded quickly.
It was
fun.
If for what it's worth, that picture is in the Memphis Belle exhibit at the National Museum of the U.S. Air Force with the airplane.
Oh wow!
Oh great!
Which is pretty awesome. So I guess next question, Chris.
First off, there's a lot of people agreeing with the quotes about bombing at night. They were, they're on your side, putting it out there.
Thank you.
Comments on that. Besides Memphis Belle, do you have a favorite World War II film?
Oh, well, Saving Private Ryan is pretty good, I gotta say. You don't think so?
I didn't say anything. It's great.
Pretty good, yeah. Battle of the Bulge, that's a pretty good one.
Yeah, The Longest Day.
How about you? It's not strictly a World War II film, but I think the film Kathy's dad made, Coming Back from the War.
Yes.
The best years of her life.
Best years of her life.
Yeah,
that's an incredible film.
It was made in 1946, so it was made really at the time that it happened. And I know for sure, you remember that when your dad came back, the way he met your mum was exactly how it was in the film. And to take the guy who'd lost his hands, and to it was a really mature and emotional film. So to me, that's probably my favorite.
Absolutely. It felt ahead of its time.
Yeah.
And my father always said that, you know, having lost his hearing during the war, he knew what it was like to come back changed and disabled and et cetera. And really tried to put that in that film.
Yeah. And I think about that when we were talking about that movie this morning, because there's that amazing image of all of the bombers that are going to be scrapped out in the desert in the beginning of the film. And as I think about all the work that everyone did here to see the unbelievable just amount of planes here that are in incredible shape, and just thinking like what you guys have done, it's overwhelming. I mean, I was excited to see these guys, but we were excited just to come to the air show. Yeah, no. Thank you. Yeah.
We have one comment that a gentleman wrote in saying that he is in aerospace engineering now because of this film.
That's great. Thanks to Tate Donovan.
I paid his tuition.
Let's see. There is a question about... good question here. What do you guys... think of the air show so far, and will you come back again?
I find it pretty overwhelming, I have to say. I didn't really know what to expect, but it's quite incredible, to be honest. The amount of different planes, the amount of different aspects of aviation, the obvious love that people have for the subject. I mean, it's just oozing everywhere. It's highly impressive. I like that, you know, whether it's about aviation or it's about anything, people really enjoying their subject. It's highly impressive. There's too much food. Speaking as a Brit.
Well, I'm already working on a suggestion for Chris so that I can come back next year.
Yeah, all right.
My wife is from Wisconsin, so I come here all the time. Go Pack! Go Pack, go. So I'll definitely be back, and this place is amazing. I've heard about it for many years, and it's more amazing than I thought.
It's great. I mean, it's a lot of planes. And I just don't know if we want to mix it up next year.
Maybe you have some boats.
Boats.
Maybe, yeah.
We got a lake right there, but otherwise,
yeah.
Keep up the good work.
So I would just make the comment so that your character, Virgil, would be Harold Locke, who is the Memphis Belle's, the real Memphis Belle's top turret gunner. He's from Wisconsin.
Yes.
He lived his whole life in Wisconsin. So another Wisconsinite.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, and it was amazing. Cheese curds! Yes! Beer! Snow!
Minnesota!
Oh. They have the snow. Yeah. Okay, yeah, yeah, Minnesota, boo! Yeah, boo! We should strafe them, in the, right? We've got the planes!
Next question, Chris.
Please!
We have a comment just says, thank you for using real aircraft in the filming. We have a reminder that, or I guess it's a question and a reminder here, that Catherine, you were actually in Best Years of Our Lives, correct?
Yes, for a moment.
What were you?
The baby.
I was a little kid, and there was a bit with teachers, with the school children and a teacher, and I can't remember what was happening, but I got... My sister got the close-up, and I got three words. I called the teacher, hey, Miss Weber.
That's pretty good. You got your SAG card.
My father was very careful to treat us both very evenly.
We have a couple questions about two different scenes. The first scene is, how many takes did it take to do the tomato soup scene?
I think it was the one.
Yeah.
Because we didn't, you know, you'd have to clean it up and start again. And I was very strict with the boys that they couldn't screw up. They had to keep going because we could only afford to do it once. So I think it was only once. Yeah, and it was good. The only laugh in the film.
The other scene is a question about the filming of the Jeep ride Amazing Grace scene and how that was all filmed, and the singing and everything.
You wouldn't be allowed to do that today with health and safety, I don't think. But it was basically, you know, Harry had been doing it, and I felt this would be a strong, you know, not all scenes have dialogue. You're looking for a tone or a feeling or something. And again, I was paranoid we wouldn't see any planes. So I thought a drive through all these planes would help make it feel bigger, because we had different kinds of planes. We had cardboard cutouts that we placed on the horizon, so they were in the distance. And you know, the shot was really based around seeing as much as we could see, and then you guys just sing.
Yeah,
get on it.
It was about the background.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, you've learned that at last.
We showcased background well.
We did a good job.
We have actually just a comment that from someone who said, when I was growing up, My two favorite movies were Memphis Belle and Space Camp, and just a thank you to Tate. So. Wow.
I gotta meet that person.
Has anybody on the stage tonight, with the exception of Jeff, of course, been out to visit the real Memphis Belle?
Well, we went to see it when it was in Memphis.
Yeah, when it was Memphis, we all there was a premiere. Or?
Yeah, I know we did the junket then.
Yeah, we did a publicity junket there. Yeah, it was great. But it was not in great repair. You know, it's kind of falling apart on this mud island, right?
Yeah, mud island.
Yeah. And then you you restored it, so thank you.
Yeah. Well, so it's kind of interesting with the Memphis Belle. So the story of that airplane is in many ways like running a race in legs. And the National Museum ran the last leg of the race and went across the finish line very publicly. But without Memphis, that airplane would not exist. So it was going to be scrapped. It was sitting in Oklahoma. It's unbelievable, these really incredibly important airplanes. Just the war ended and everybody wanted to go back to their lives. I mean, it was, and you know, today we wouldn't let that happen. But back then it was such a massive war. We lost so many people. And the Memphis Belle was going to be scrapped. And the city of Memphis decided that they wanted to have it. So it was flown there, and it was outside for quite a while, so it did have some decay, but the citizens did their best to try and preserve the airplane, and it's interesting in that if you look at air museums up until about the 80s, the airplanes are sitting outside, just like the Belle was, and so a group is formed in Memphis in the 80s called the Memphis Belle Memorial Association. They raised money, and they did their best to care for it. But in the case of the Air Force, that has enormous resources, and so when the Belle came up to the National Museum in 2005, it really went to a place that had the resources, the facilities, the staff, and so on, and not volunteers, but professionals. So I've always seen the city of Memphis really did save the Belle, and then when it came up to the National Museum, it really got in the hands of, you know, full-time professionals and so on. So. And what was amazing, too, is that Memphis, when the airplane came up, it was heartbreaking. I mean, it was this, you know, iconic part of that area. And when the airplane came up, they were heartbroken. But in Memphis, they fully supported that restoration, came up, donated materials, helped find equipment and things like that. So they actually were part of the restoration as well from afar. But they did visit, and all the logbooks, all the things that were associated with the airplane came up. So it really was a huge team effort. So, but I would encourage, and I hope all of you come out and see the restored airplane. We'd love to have you out there. It really is quite magnificent. 55,000 man hours of restoration in 13 years to put that airplane on display with love and care by everyone else. Okay, next question, Chris.
Let's see, we have the gear that you used in the filming. Was that reproduction gear or was it leftover surplus type gear?
It was mostly real. Yeah. Leftover, right?
No.
Like the clothes?
Our wardrobe? Yeah, they made it. They made our clothes. But the wardrobe fitting was a lot like an army fitting. I remember that. They were, you know, usually it's a fun experience to pick out your wardrobe, but they were just like, "Here, you're wearing that." Just like,
"Oh, I learned something new today."
Really?
I thought it was all the real deal.
Well, the Memphis Belle jacket.
But I mean, like the blue, the heating suits, and all that stuff.
It was so hot. Oh my God.
I think the question was about landing gear.
Oh, landing gear?
Oh, we thought you meant gear. Was the landing gear real? Absolutely.
We have a question that I guess I'm going to answer for you guys, and that is, have you been inside of a B-17 since filming? And we are doing that tomorrow with you guys, so you're going to need to go inside Aluminum Overcast.
Awesome. I love it. Can't wait. Love it.
No, I haven't been. I couldn't get in the ball to it, man. I was too big.
It was pretty tough to get into. You had to.
Yeah.
You had to pull yourself up. You had to pole vault to get in there.
Yeah.
That's actually one of the questions was, you guys made it look really easy climbing in through the nose hatch. How many times did you have to practice that?
A lot.
A lot. Yeah.
We were young.
To look good.
Yeah.
We wanted to look good, so like we had done it many times, so we did it many times, yeah.
One question was, how hard was it to condense the entire Memphis Belle tour of duty into a two-hour movie?
Again, as I said, we weren't trying to recreate the actual last mission, because nothing particularly happened on that. So once you make the decision, you're trying to illustrate what the environment was like for a lot of different people. You have a grab bag of incidents, and as I said, in copying Willie Wyler's documentary, it was in sections. So I've lost my train of thought. Happens.
How do you feel about Memphis Belle compared to Masters of the Air?
Well, strangely enough, my daughter, who was 3 or 4 years old at the time when we made it, she worked on Masters of the Air as a second assistant. And I used to get a lot of information from her about what they were doing wrong. In my opinion, a really simple thing is you've got 10 different characters now. You have to tell them apart to understand how the interactions are going. So I worked very hard on, the way Billy Zane looked, his moustache and the thing, and having a cravat versus having a scarf, having it open, having it closed. Everybody, all of them wanted to wear mirror shades, which was like, no, you're not. I've only got your eyes. Because most of it is like this. This is all you see. And I felt they knew what they were doing with Masters of the Air, but they weren't taking care of very simple things like that, that really allow the audience to engage with that character. A lot of the time you couldn't tell who was who and what was going on. I also feel that the use of CGI was crap compared to what we did. Not that ours is a product of its period, but there is a textural thing that you can't get from CGI. It looks great, it looks impressive, but it looks clean. It doesn't look natural. And I felt that kind of took away from, they had the drama on one side of the thing, but when you got into the air, it was very clean by comparison to what we had found. They did some things that were marvelous, but I don't think the subject matter benefits by being able to swoop around with a camera. That's kind of showing off in a way, and it's not staying to me closer to what the subject is, which is about the strife that these men were going through. That's my own personal opinion.
I didn't see it. Did you see it?
I refused. I didn't see it. No.
Were any inspirations taken from 12 O'Clock High, or did you watch any of it in preparation?
No, not 12 O'Clock High. There was a Howard Hawks film, which I can't remember the name, Air Force or something, it was about B-17s, and that had been made. What he did is, of course, 10,000 feet, okay, you can come off your oxygen. So everybody ripped him off and just carried on talking, which wasn't the case, and it wasn't what we were trying to express anyway. So I watched that and I thought, okay, we'll not do that. We will take the high road. There was also a Steven Spielberg made a thing called some Wild Tales. It was part of a
Amazing Stories. Yeah.
Amazing
yeah.
Stories, something yeah. like that. And what he had done, obviously the same as I, you'd go onto an airplane and you go, oh my God, it's tiny. How are we going to make this look bigger or more cinematic? And what he chose to do was put a wider angle lens on. He was using that. And Again, that inspired me to go the opposite way because it wasn't what I had found. So I guess I could take inspiration from those two about what not to do.
And Jeff, I think we have one more here, but we should probably close with a very special happy birthday to a few people on stage. Mm-hmm. So Catherine, I think you're getting ready to have a birthday Friday.
That's true.
I believe Linda Morgan, her birthday is the same day. And I think Reed just had a birthday that we missed. I'm sorry. Happy birthday.
Happy birthday. Happy birthday.
The last comment from backstage, from a lot of people commenting, is just a simple thank you, all of you, for making this big trip out here to see us. So thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Okay, with that, we'll close the show. One last round of applause for our guests. Thank you for your time. Thank you.